Let's see what the stew has in store for us today.
Welcome to the Gnomecast, Gnome Stew's tabletop gaming advice podcast. Here we talk with the other gnomes about gaming things to avoid becoming part of the stew, so I guess we'd better be good. This time, we're not talking with another gnome. You have me, Jared, your friendly neighborhood interview gnome, and our special guest, Lou Anders. Where might listeners to the Gnomecast know you from?
Well, and let me say right off, I was sitting here wondering, am I a gnome? I think I'm more of a dwarf. I'd love to be an elf, but I think that dwarf is what fits. I am the publisher of Lazy Wolf Studios that does the Thrones and Bones adventure games based on the Thrones and Bones books. Prior to that, I was a science fiction fantasy editor for 10 years, and prior to that, I was a journalist in Los Angeles, so people may know me from a wide variety of places.
What made you settle on the Thrones and Bones storyline for the books, and what is the series, if you don't mind explaining?
The series is a children's series. The game is not a children's game. Just like Star Wars can do Skeleton Crew and Andor both.
Yeah.
I have a three-book series called Thrones and Bones that's out from Random House, and it's the initial book is called Frostborn, and just the first book takes place in a Norse-inspired land called Norengard, or Norungard. And it stars a 12 or 13-year-old girl whose father is a frost giant, and so she's 7 feet tall and has grown up around people who are much taller and is incredibly tough, and a young boy who is kind of the rich kid on the biggest farm around and doesn't want to inherit it and have to do any work. And the two of them are chased by different enemies and go on the run into the frozen Scandinavian-style wilderness, chased by trolls and draugr undead and everything else. In the series, they then go on to cross about 2,000 miles of continent and visit a lot of other cultures, and we get a lot of fun out of these Norse characters thrust into bigger, more cosmopolitan settings. And then there's an associated book called Once Upon a Unicorn, which is in the same world, but completely different storyline about an island that has been taken over and annexed by the Fae. It's unicorns live in the north and nightmares live in the south. And the Seely live up north and the Unseely live down south, but neither of them are wonderful people.
That's always been an interesting thing to me because I've seen people oversimplify Seely and Unseely as good and bad. And it's like, nah.
It's just different shades of bad. That one is the book that's pitched the youngest, but it's I wanted to write it so that like a parent reading it with their child would read between the lines and realize that, because the book's all about unicorns. But if you were a human being who visited that island, it would be terrifying. And I think you can read between the lines and see that. If I may, there's a character, the only human in the book is a guy named Poor Matt Tom, and he used to be a guest of the good Fairy Queen, and he sees her again, and she's like, won't you come back to the palace? And he's like, I don't think I will. And she says, well, come on, we weren't bad to you. We always put you back together after we took you apart. You know, you realize that's why he's Poor Matt Tom. They maybe didn't do a good job of that. But that's the only, like, you know, thing that I think you'd read that and go, okay, he knows what the real Seely were like. But in 2020, I had the idea of seeing if I could, I needed a change of pace. The pandemic was just kicking in. And I thought, I'll do like a little 30-page adventure set in the Norse land of Norengard and just see if I can do it. Just do a 30-page quick little adventure in the frozen north. And that turned into a huge, fat, thick campaign setting guide with a companion adventure book with a whole like first to eighth level adventure path. And, you know, it was a tale that grew in the telling. Since then, I think we've put out about 11 books, supplements and adventures, plus a bunch of ancillary product, all to date set in Norengard, as the current project is. I'm sitting on a whole bunch of adventures that take place in some of the other countries, and we'll get to that at the end of this year, beginning of next.
Am I misremembering, or have I seen artwork that was labeled for other regions of the setting somewhere?
I think the only thing that I've put out is the map of the full continent.
Okay.
There is a ton of artwork for other settings, but but I don't think I've released any of it. Maybe I've sent it to you privately.
I just vaguely remember that, and I don't know where I saw it from.
I might have shared some of the fairy folk with you. The plan right now, and you know, plans are subject to change, is to do a monster book and book of adventures at the end of this year, and the book of adventures will be set everywhere. Sarah Madsen has written one that's sort of Jason the Argonaut style adventure that takes place off the Grecian continent.
since this started in the Norse inspired area, what makes that compelling to you? What made that the jumping off point for you?
I think there's a number of things. I think I've always loved it in the back of my mind ever since the gods, demigods and heroes, deities and demigods, Dungeons and Dragons. There's that wonderful picture of Thor bringing his hammer down on the world serpent. That really connected with me. And then when I started the children's series, I had this completely naive idea. I mean, I was working as a science fiction and fantasy editor, so all of my peers were and friends were award-winning fantasy writers. You know, I mean, I was hanging out with people who were just absolute geniuses, and I thought, I can't write something and offer it into that space. So I'll write something for in the middle reader space, 10 to 12. To make it easy, I'll pick this tiny little frozen corner of the world. And then I started writing and realized I have to know who these people are if I'm going to write about them. And so before I ever plotted anything, I ended up researching heavily into Scandinavia and falling in love with it. But also every time when they went and sacked England, now I have to know who my faux English people are. When they sacked Ireland, I have to know who my faux, with about 40,000 words of countries and cultures and gods for nations that were 1,000 miles away. it's not how I recommend writing. You know, they say start small and work your way out. And I didn't. I built the whole friggin' place.
It's really funny because anytime I hear someone talking about just making their own campaign setting and saying, just focus on this area, I do that exact same thing. Like once I start thinking, this is very much like this culture, but that culture was inspired by this culture. So there has to be something that mirrors that culture too. And then it just snowballs from there.
Absolutely. And to be fair, I hate monocultures. Mm-hmm. Unless we're talking about the ice planet Hoth, which is friggin' cool. I hate monocultures. I hate cultures that have no influences beyond their borders. You know, there are a couple other Norse-inspired settings out there, and a few of them, it's like Norse planet.
Mm-hmm.
I don't want to live on Norse planet. And also, there's a scene in the first novel where the boy finds a magic sword, and he meets the dragon Orm, and Orm sniffs at it and says, that's not one of mine, but it has a storied history. And that's all that's said. But I had like 1,000 words on how that sword was the Excalibur in a matriarchal Celtic King Arthur type storyline, Queen Arthur. And it's ended up in Norngard, and it's ended up becoming part of recent Norranian legend. But because I did all that legwork, even though it didn't show in the book, it allowed it to bubble out in little references that lend authenticity to the setting and make you feel like it's not just the yellow brick road. And if you step off it, there's nothing there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and no one is in isolation. All cultures give and take. So I'm always looking for ways to show outside influences and back and forth.
It's really interesting to me, and this is going further afield than I mean to, but there almost seems to be, on one hand, your Tolkien kind of mindset where it's like, I need to understand everything that influences this thing to write about this thing. And then on the other side, I tend to think of like George Lucas's process, which is I need to hint that there's more, but I don't know what the more is. I just want to make sure that I hint that there's more out there.
That's there too. And in fact, when I started turning this into RPGs and now I'm moving in the stuff I'm working on into other countries, I'm realizing that I did a lot of hinting for a lot of those, and I need to go back and lay more groundwork.
I've never been able to completely put my finger on it. I've always loved giants. So when I started reading the books, that was like an instant in right there. Speaking of older D&D books, I remember reading through the Manual of the Planes, and when they start talking about Jotunheim, they start throwing out these random names for giants. And especially Utgard Loki was the one that got me, because I was like, why is there this other person that is named the same thing as another character from this mythology? And it just got me rolling into reading all of that stuff, and it just hooked me into it.
And, you know, you're talking about names, too. There used to be a program. I don't think you may still be able to find a clone of it, but I'm not even sure it'll run on any iOS now, any Windows DOS, called The Ever-Changing Book of Names. And it was created by a gamer about 20 years ago who hated doofy-sounding fantasy names that weren't consistent. So you would type in 30 or 40 real world, either place or people names, and it had some kind of proprietary algorithm that turned it into binary, scrambled it, and then spat it back out. And so you would get things that sounded like they came from a culture. The way that George Martin, to mention him again, the way that he'd take Edward and make it Eddard, or Lancaster and make it Lannister. It would spit out things like that. And, you know, it would spit out 100 things and you pick the three good ones. But I scrambled all of the giant names to get Magnolmir as her father's name.
I love that. Like I said, I have no idea why. I love giants. So you give me a half giant protagonist and I'm hooked on that. So we're all good there. We touched on you looking at other products from the setting. Are there any more books on the way that you can talk about?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I should probably talk about the one that's on Kickstarter now first and then move.
Yeah,
past
I know.
which do you want me to talk about?
Right now, I'm just kind of curious if there's any more fiction that's, you know, rolling out there.
Oh,
yeah.
Fiction. No, you know, the children's fiction market has just collapsed and the fantasy branch of it even more so. So I have a manuscript, the three different drafts of a manuscript set in the faux English part of the world of Knights and Dragons. It's guilting me into thinking I should go back and finish it, even if like I just put it out myself or something. I do owe it to that story to finish it one day because it's a great story. And I started a YA starring a slightly older version of my dark elf character, Destra. I might finish that one day, but both of those are back burner projects. And then we did do, I don't know if you saw, we did do an adult short story anthology that I'm not in, but a bunch of other writers are, called Tales from Stolke's Hall.
Yes.
Yeah, which is some very hard hitting and some creepy stories set in Norengard specifically.
When we talk about the setting, especially from a gaming standpoint, I have had a hard time exactly explaining this to people, but I really like the fact that Norengard feels like a D&D setting and a Norse setting both, without, you know, necessarily being exactly what another D&D setting would do with it. And it's hard for me to put my finger on it. I think part of it is the fact that they are sort of just kind of almost past the raiding part of things and into the more agrarian merchant type culture.
No, they're past it. The High King put the kibosh on it. It actually may have been a century since they've raided, and they're reframing their society to, you know, originally raiding was really what you respected. And everybody who dies, it's not the Norse pantheon, although they're analogs. So when you die, unless you get chosen for one of the halls, you go to Neth's cave underground. And recently they've reframed it. So if you're a landowner with a really big farm, you get a really big farm when you go there. So there's honor in, you know, things other than raiding. You're told in the campaign setting that the city of Umsberg, which is way out on the western end where it's really cold, they've started raiding again. So far, the Jarl is just pretending he hasn't noticed that because he doesn't want to deal with it. They have a reason that they're raiding again, which I won't spoil for players, but there's a dark secret in Umsberg, and we haven't done anything there yet either. I need to go out there, but it is way out there on the western end of the continent. And there are people who feel like the city of Binsa is my entry point city to Norengard. And Binsa is getting very cosmopolitan, and the Jarl of Binsa loves foreign wine and entertaining merchants and things like that. But there are, the further you get from that, the more traditional it gets. And there are factions that think that the Jarl is way too modern and that they need to get rid of him and return to their roots.
Yeah, I think there's something about the way that the culture sits now in that post-raiding thing that works better for D&D adventuring, at least in my mind, because I have seen some products come out that are like Viking-based. I'm by no means saying that they're bad, but I have a hard time picturing how I would run a game where my players are on a ship raiding people. I don't know how I would deal with that.
Yeah.
But I can deal with a bunch of people that are like, hey, I want to get rich and famous outside of the normal paradigm of the jobs that are available to me. I'm going to go explore some ruins. I get that.
And you get one of the wonderful things about the setting and also like actual Norway is all the settlements are on the coast.
Mm-hmm.
Or the majority of them are. The western half tends to be more mountainous. The eastern half is flat and has more areas where you can have more settlements. But so you have all these wilderness expanses, whether it's huge forests or mountains, where there are dangers and ruins and a lot of spirits of the land and trolls. And then right above you is Ymiria, which is the frost giant land, but it's also got ancient dwarven holds and the city of Trollheim, where the troll king lives. And so there's plenty of opportunity for adventurous people to go off and gain glory without having to go sack some monastery in Unglin or Arlen next door, you know?
That is an interesting thing I also wanted to touch on, is that for people that are used to D&D Frost Giants, these aren't Frost Giants, you know, raiding the their neighbors or crushing buildings and stealing from people. It's just another culture in this region.
Yep. They're giant people. They're giant people. And some of them are peaceful and some of them are not. And some of them are, would rather be left alone. And some of them trade with humans. And there is, they used to have an empire. There are some Frost Giants who miss that and would like to bring that back one day. But there are also, you know, Frost Giants who craft and come down during the height of winter to trade with the human settlements.
As someone overly obsessed with giants, I realize that Norse mythology is not nearly as granular as D&D, but are there any other species or cultures of giants beyond the Frost Giants out there?
There are, but not in Norngard. One of the things that I really tried hard to do with the setting is to make monsters regional.
Mm-hmm.
And this came from writing the books, because when we did the audiobooks, my audiobook producer, the first thing she asked me was, do monsters come from monster land? Like, should they have an accent that is common to all monsters, or do they live among the population and they have regional accents? And I said, you know, for the people of Norengard, they're not living alongside the supernatural creatures, except for the Huldra, which they are not always aware of. But for the rest of the continent, it's much more common to have the supernatural alongside of you. And so we went with monsters all have regional accents. And so, like, you don't get ogres that far out of Escarraine, the French-influenced land. And gnomes all come from Nalinia and Thobovo. And, you know, people in Norgard have never seen a gnome. They wouldn't know what one was. They'd think it was a beardless dwarf or something. And the dark elves, the Svartalfar, who are actually really pale-skinned, the Svartalfar are the only elves that you get in Norngard. And occasionally a wood elf will come from, you know, but they're not native to Norngard. And that's also why I don't have the monster languages. There's no giant language. The giants speak what they speak. And, you know, they speak what the people speak. They speak Naranian. And an ogre would speak Escarraine, and the gnome would speak Nalinian. And we have the esoteric languages, but not the mundane monster languages, except for dragon, of course.
Dragons always have to be special.
Absolutely. And there are other giants, but they're different. There's a mountain called the Muspeli Mountain Range, which is about 2,000 miles away, that's full of fire giants. And I think there's some forest giants in the German area of the land. But they're in their place, and we'll get to them when we get to them.
Since we've been talking about this in general, can you explain what Fury of the Forsaken is?
Yeah, so it's written with by myself and Richard Pett of Weeby Goblins and Cat and Mouse fame. I've wanted to work with Richard ever since I played Cat and Mouse. Almost, that wasn't designing back then. But it's an adventure for fourth level, and I previously put out for the Tales of the Valiant system, although they play with Dungeons & Dragons fine, three shorter adventures, Banner of the Bull, which I wrote, Keeper of the Drowned, which Brian Suskin wrote, and Troll of the Town, which Kelly Pollock wrote. And those three adventures take you from level one to level three. So you could play them as, and we're collecting, as part of the Kickstarter, we're collecting them in a hardcover volume that'll expand them. And so you could play those through and then be ready to go right into Fury of the Forsaken. And Fury is a book-length adventure. I think it's 111 pages right now, and I haven't put all the art into the appendix yet, so it's definitely going to get bigger than that. I think we've done something really, really epic. The setup is, players, plug your ears, you're tasked by the Jarl of Binsa to take some cattle to the small village of Smarvik, which is a tiny village, because they're predicting a really, really bad winter. And, you know, the thing about both Norngard and Norway is you can go from t-shirt weather to 30 feet of snow in October in a week. And so they're like, get these cattle to this village, they're going to need it. And you get to the village and it's gone. And some hunters come out of the woods and tell you that they've been slaughtered by something that they've never seen before. And you have to get to the bigger town of Frekkerheim, which is a lake town at the terminus of a fjord. And you get there and then you're snowed in, and a undead army rises out of the water and announces they're going to return in 3 days and slaughter everyone in the town. And so it's seven samurai, and the town has had a hard time lately. People don't like the new Jarl, and a lot of the young people have left. And so you have children and old folks and a town guard barely keeping it together. And you have to recruit and arm and train the locals to defend from this siege that's coming in 3 days. And the weather's so bad, you couldn't possibly get these people, the old people and the young people, out.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're going to be a hero, you've got to stay and arm them. But everything's not kosher in this town. So there's also a mystery, and there's a monster called the Vitargalkin, the Winter Beast, and it has its own agenda. And you can investigate this mystery and see what's going on, or you can ignore the mystery. And either way, it ends in a huge climactic battle. And I think it's really epic.
I'm not quite sure where this lives in my head, but I love Draugr and that whole feel. I think part of it comes from going back to how the Barrow-wites felt in Lord of the Rings when I first read that, and how D&D has whites, but they don't really feel that special. They're just that tier of undead that is more dangerous than zombies, but not a death knight, that sort of thing. But there is something about Draugr that just feels visceral and different.
Well, they're almost somewhere between a white and a vampire. The thing is that they're intelligent. They're people who, for whatever reason, couldn't let go. Either they were too greedy or too ambitious, or they wanted revenge too badly. So they're malevolent. Sometimes they're trapped where they're buried, but other times they're not. And we have different levels of Draugr. And one of the reasons for that is because, one, we needed a minion that you could slaughter in great numbers. But also in actual Norse mythology, Draugr had a range of different powers. Sometimes they could turn into a giant and back. Other times they could transform. They would turn into an evil-looking cat, a horse with its back broken, or a donkey with its ears chopped off and its sides flayed and bleeding. And they could come to you in your dreams and suck the life out of you. The cat could come to you in dreams and get on your chest at night and suck the life out of you. And so, the different Draugr have these different abilities. You could have low-level minion Draugrs. What we call the Draugr Warriors is a little tougher. The Draugr Elite is even tougher, and the Draugr Jarl is extremely tough. And so, you've got these levels that you could progress through. Some of them could be boss monsters easily.
One of the things that kind of grabbed my imagination at one point in time was that they're in a body, but it's not necessarily their body. It's a body that's in this burial mound somewhere, and they need something to move around. Like you said, there's so many different neat stories about Draugr and their powers, and it is very much that regional, here is an undead that we have so much folklore about.
And there's one one of his minions shows up very briefly in the adventure we did, Vengeance of the Valaravn, which is another book-length hardcover adventure. But in that, there's a Draugr in the city of Sindholm who isn't that bad. He's buried with his ship, which was something they did, in the middle of town. And at night, you come out of the mead hall, and you can hear him singing. He used to be a sailor, and you can hear him singing sea shanties he's picked up from all over the world. You could imagine like a drunk stumbling out of the mead hall, hearing the singing, passing out on the hill and singing with him.
Mm-hmm.
He's cool with that. Now, if you went into his burrow, he might kill you. But if you want to sit on his burrow and sing sea shanties with him all night, that's fine. And I have in Vengeance of the Valaravn, he may or may not assist the party against a threat in his city that he doesn't like. But it's like, the mob boss helping you fight the Nazi. It's not like you trust him entirely.
Yeah.
I want to do something with him. I want him to be a quest giver in something later.
I like that feel, because what I think some undead adventures, and I'm guilty of this too when I make things up, there are stories about the undead that are just creepy, and then there are full-on horror stories. And we tend to lean more towards the horror stories in our games and not so much on just the, wow, that was just a chilling thing that happened. Like, I wasn't in any danger, but just the idea that this is this thing from beyond the grave that is filled with sorrow and is never going to actually move on from this place. It is a different feel that is hard to zoom in on, where it's not just go in there, throw holy water on it, and set it on fire.
I think, like I said, the way they're almost like vampires is that they definitely have, individual Draugr will have specific motivations. I would play a Draugr lord closer to Strahd than I would like a zombie or something.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things I've tried to do with the setting is that, and I think you could see the difference between like the Draugr in Fury of the Forsaken is quite evil and there's nothing silly about him. And the Draugr in Sindholm that likes to sing sea shanties can be played comedically.
Mm.
Actual Norse mythology could be incredibly grim or really funny. That's the other thing about, and not to, some of the Norse settings I've glanced at are just, all they took was the grim. It's just, let's do the blood eagle on everybody.
Yeah.
That's not actually accurate that leaves out all the humor, all the cross-dressing, all the sex changing. You know,
anyone that's ever read the story about Odin and getting poetry and where bad poetry comes from.
I think that the adventures we put out are surfing that whole range. I've got inflatable bouncing cats in one adventure. And
oh, I love those. I ran my players in that adventure, and that was great.
If you've seen In Vengeance of the Valravn, you have Meilinger, which is the ghost of unburied children.
Mm-hmm.
That's extremely creepy and needs a content warning.
Yes.
So, you know, I want the whole range. I want to be able to play both bouncing kittens and dead ghost kids.
That has become a thing now where I have seen Meilinger, you know, the variations on that in so many things now where I'm like, if I see that and no one else knows what that is, it's like, okay, we need to talk first before this content shows up. Yep.
Oh, and the public service announcement, the AR is the plural. So it's Draugr, Draugr, Meiling, Meilingar. I'm probably, the R is probably softer than that, but the AR makes a lot of things plural.
And I'm always like terrible at remembering which form to use too. But at least I'm consistent because I'm like that with like Slod and Slotty and all of those too. Efreet, Efreeti. So one of the stretch goals I noticed is doing an updated version of the campaign setting with Tales of the Valiant upgrades. And I just was kind of curious, what do you think that looks like? What would you be looking at changing? And what makes Tales of the Valiant an attractive setting for you or an attractive game system for you?
One of the things it would look like, of course, updating all the player classes and the splitting race into lineage and heritage. And that has been done in the Player's Guide to Norngard. So you can get the Tales of the Valiant version of that. So we'd plug that in.
Yes. And honestly, when I first saw that in Banner of the Bull, that is one of the things that drove home to me what a good storytelling tool that is to break that into two separate things. Because you did a really good job of making those a meaningful split in there. I really enjoyed that.
Thank you. Well, that is one of the things I like best about Tales of Valiant, because it was what I was already doing. The dwarves in my world had an exodus, a diaspora, where most of them left Norngard in prehistory. And the ones that stayed just live above ground in the human settlements with the people. Their culture is the same as a human. It's Noranian.
Mm-hmm.
And the ones that left, a lot of them went to Arland, which is a Celtic culture. And so they would have an Arlish heritage. And then a number of them settled in the mountains. And if you wanted a traditional Tolkien-esque dwarf, that's where you'd find them, in the mountains between Norngard and Arlen. But the ones that live in Arlen have an Arlish background. The ones that live in Norngard speak Noranian. They don't speak Dwarvish, and they have, you know, they behave just like anybody else. I was already in my writing doing that shift of your genes and your environment. It just fit so nicely. You know, other things I like, just in principle, I like the way they handle weapon mastery better. But the monster creation rules, and I don't think enough people who are writing for Tales of the Valiant are paying attention to the monster creation rules in the Game Master's Guide, because it's not formatting. It's a whole precise formula for how they make monsters, and it's so accurate. It's so wonderful to use. It takes there's a little bit of a learning curve to do it right, and then it produces such quality results, so much easier than the monster creation rules in the 2014 DMG.
I was just going to say, I don't want to get too much of a dig in here, but are you saying that if the Game Master's Guide actually gives you guidelines for what the game expects out of the monsters, it's actually easier for you to design for the game?
Gee, I at some point I'm going to have to do something for 2024, but I really dread trying to make a 2024 monster. But with the Game Master's Guide for Tales of the Valiant, the monster stuff is amazing. So one of the things I would do is I would go through all the monsters that were in the book, and I would convert them. And that would probably see some of them change significantly, just because I think the TOV versions are more balanced. And also, you know, you're encouraged to do more with bonus actions and things in TOV.
I really like that, because there are some monsters that just get too boring when they are just like, I get it, it's an interesting creature, but in combat, it rolls to hit you and does damage. And I really like it when things have more reactions and bonus actions for the GM to play with, so you're not just tracking hit points on this sack of meat.
I hate when I buy a monster book and it's all just, it has a bow attack and it has a sword, a claw attack or something, you know, sword attack or a bite attack. But so, yeah, there'll be some work, and I've already done some of that work. And I've also built a lot of monsters that have not shown up anywhere. I traced the Beowulf story back as far as I could, then built it forward from that into what's called a Shadow Troll. And that hasn't been in any publication yet. And so the Shadow Troll would be in the conversion if we get there, and a few other things.
I like that. I mean, amongst other things that I'm weird about, when we read Beowulf in high school, they only had us read the first part, and I ended up reading the entire thing, and I have reread it and have audiobooks of it, so that's another thing that lives in my brain rent-free there.
Well, you know, one of the things I'm really proud of is in Tales from Stolke's Hall, everybody there is a professional writer except for my nephew, who is one now, but he's a linguist, and I had mentioned as an in-joke in the campaign setting the Bear Son's Tale, which is my in-world version of Beowulf. And so when we did Tales from Stolke's Hall, I said, do you think you could write a Beowulf-esque epic called The Bear's Son's Tale? And he did. It reads like Beowulf, and it's huge. He wrote a saga in verse, in just like something, just it sounds just like Beowulf. And so now we have an in-world story that the Skalds recite in the Mead Hall.
I know this is, again, going off on a tangent here, but I love all this stuff. Have you read the Thor comic from the Simonson era when he is fighting the Midgard serpent and it is all done as an epic poem?
No, I need to find that.
It is great. I love it. It is so great. And that was during the time when like Thor is cursed and he can't die, but he can't heal from any of his injuries. So he's literally wearing armor that keeps his body together because Hela has cursed him. God, it was so great. But the whole thing with him fighting the Midgard serpent is just done in poetic verse all the way through it. It was great. I love it.
Oh, that's awesome. I'll see if that's on the Marvel app.
I think they have most of Simonson's runs. I hope it is. I mean, I know a lot of people say, well, Thor isn't that accurate to Norse mythology. In some places it is. Yes, they do. They do take some big liberties in a few places, but in a few places.
When people complain that King Arthur isn't that accurate, there's 1,000 years of Arthurian stories that are blatantly contradictory of each other. You know, there's no reason that should stop. There's no reason you can't tell new author stories. It's not like, I'm sure there were people in you know, 1500 going, well, that doesn't match what King Arthur did in 800 AD.
I was on a comic book podcast one time and I was pointing that out, like things like Lex Luthor becoming a billionaire after just being a criminal scientist, and how that is stuck with every version since then. That is just like the idea that at one point in time, Lancelot was not part of the Arthurian legend.
Yep.
So yeah, I do like how these things build on each other and kind of take the things that resonate.
When he did, he messed around with a different woman. It wasn't Guinevere. It was it was another king's daughter at one point, or wife, another king's wife.
We touched on this a little bit, but I was going to ask how soon we might be seeing more information on like Quaternia, or the Wilderness of the Bear Folk, or the Gordian Supremacy, or Theka. Also slightly self-serving because my players started making characters for Midgard in Kobold Press, and then I decided to run here, and they all still wanted to have characters from elsewhere. So some of them are from places we only have a vague impression of.
Well, first, if you ask me about those places, I can tell you. And two, I've got two adventures set in Ireland. One was written by Sebastian Rombach. I've got the aforementioned Jason the Argonauts adventure that Sarah Madsen wrote that's set in Sarn's Teeth, which is the archipelago of islands that are south of the Greek continent of Theka. I have another adventure written by Sebastian Rombach that takes place in Theka, in a city that is a joint city between humans and dryads. And the city is on a series of islands in the middle of a large river. And every single island has canals so that, you know, you have a human street and you have a canal for the dryads. Another adventure is set in the Kelly Pollock wrote is set in the faux Germany area of Termini. And I'm working on one in the city of Castlebriar in Alinea, which is also in the second book, Nightborn. And that will be an arc that travels around Alinea and hits several different cities. And I have an amazing idea for a hex crawl in the faux Russian area of the land that it's a back burner project, but it's really fun. About 2 months ago, sat down and really detailed the Portuguese-esque area of the world. And Richard Pett, I asked him to write a 5,000-word story. He just told me it's 20,000 words. So we have another book-length adventure from Richard Pett. It'll be a while because he and I will probably pass it back and forth for a long time. But it's in Ungland. And Ungland is Britain if the Church of England were totalitarian. The same way that Odin becomes Wotan in other areas of Europe, the Norns become the Three Sisters for Ungland, Saeslin, and Swithinmark. And they each put one of the three forward as the one that they worship the most. And they venerate all three, but in, you know, in one country, one will be foremost and the other two will be in back, and they'll switch that up. And Unglin has gone isolationist, dropped the other two. I think it's Urd that they put forward, and is outlawing divination magic and closing their borders, imposing tariffs on everybody.
You say that as if, you know, closing your borders in a paranoid stance is kind of a bad thing.
Richard is working on a very Wicker Man inspired first level adventure set in a smaller village there. But I'd like to do some like V for Vendetta type stuff there later.
Yeah, I was going to say, I really love getting into like the Kobold Press stuff, but I loved a lot of the old Margreave stuff just because it does have that folklore-ish, not quite over-the-top kind of horror adjacent, but also just kind of weird, like you don't fully understand what's going on type of things going on. And I really like that when you can work that into a setting like that.
That is my hands-down favorite setting book. I'll sign my own stuff. The Omar Grave is brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant.
Yeah, I've run people through all of the adventures in the 5e version of it. So, and Ange, who is both a gnome and my partner on the Thaco with Advantage podcast, is currently running her people through the updated Tales of the Valiant version. So we've been comparing notes as she's been doing that. So when my group played through Banner of the Bull, I don't want to spoil this too much, but they really appreciated that there is a certain LGBTQIA plus relationship that is kind of the crux of part of the story. They really appreciated that, and they were actually kind of happy to be able to interact with that a little bit. And also the fact that you have a subclass that basically is talking about how someone's gender is not, you know, necessarily the same as what people may have assumed it was at birth. And that's not how you determine whether somebody that has to be in a woman-only subclass is part of that subclass. I just kind of wanted to, you know, touch base with some of your thoughts on, you know, that kind of inclusion in this setting.
First of all, it's completely historical. The vulva were the seers. They were, and I struggled with that when I made them because they carried a staff. The name means carrier of the magic staff, a Sather staffer. And so I thought they're wizards. You know, they got a staff like Gandalf, they're wizards. And then I tried to force them into the wizard class for a long time. And then I finally sat back, like, this isn't working. I looked at what they do. They're shapeshifters. They control the weather. They tell the future. They're healers. They're seers. I went, oh my God, they're druids. Why? It was so obvious. I just couldn't see it for the longest time because of that damn stick.
When you read that subclass, it just clicks. Yeah, these are druids. This is a druid circle.
They were primarily women, because Sather, the magic, was the art of a woman's art. But Odin, of course, was a master of it, and no one would impinge his manhood for that. But historically, some men could become vulva, but when they did, they were required to take on the garb and dress like the seeresses did. And I think that it's not a stretch to imagine that that was probably a socially acceptable place for people who were trans before there was a word for that, to go and fit into the society. The other thing about, I mean, the Vikings were not saints, as we touched on. In fact, I wish it had been around when I was writing the books. Assassin's Creed Valhalla, I love, because it does a wonderful job of deconstructing what's toxic about Viking society. Mm-hmm. The lead character goes on a journey where she's literally confronting the toxicity in her culture and figuring out how is she going to reconcile that. And it's so, so well done. You know, they saw absolutely nothing wrong with sailing across the water and sacking a place and butchering everyone and hauling back slaves. A woman could divorce her husband just by saying, get out.
Mm-hmm.
And then if he didn't leave, he was in trouble. We know for a fact now that they were women warriors. And in the contemporary European literature, women are either temptresses or damsels in distress.
Mm-hmm.
The Viking literature, women are just warriors. They're just heroes.
Yeah.
There are stories about women warriors and stories about male warriors. They were, for their time, ahead of their European counterparts in a lot of ways. They also bathed more.
I can't remember exactly, but there was an account of the people complaining that these Norsemen...
They were too good-looking. Yeah. They were too good-looking. They used perfume, and they cleaned themselves. They stopped bathing when Christians convinced them it was vanity. Give our men a chance. But they also, because life was so harsh, you know, making babies was very important. But once you'd done that, once you had one or two kids that made it, they didn't care what you did. So, you know, it was absolutely fine for two men to be together, provided they had previously fulfilled their societal expectation of reproducing. But once they did that, if they wanted it, no one cared. No one cared. And of course, you know, again, the gender fluidity is all through the stories.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
All through the stories. Yeah.
That is the thing that gets me about a lot of historical things, is that just because other cultures did not use the exact same name, and there might be some nuance where people in that culture that did this never did the certain thing here, but otherwise it lines up with what we understand now, people discount that and act like everything is brand new and that these aren't just normal parts of the human experience.
Well, the other thing too, that was, it was early on when I was facing all this, when I was making the setting book, I had a tier in the Kickstarter where you could pledge and be drawn into the setting. The Norse society uses patronymics and metronymics, daughter and son, you know, Eric's son, Eric's daughter. And so I asked this one backer what they want their name to be. And that's when they tell me that they were non-binary. And so I didn't want to name their character son or daughter.
Mm-hmm.
And so we came up with Bjorn, which means born. And so they played a Huldra, which are the hidden people. And so they were Forest Bjorn. I forgot what the word we used for forest was, but we took Bjorn as, and so it's in the book. That's the non-gendered suffix for the surname.
By the way, it was very interesting describing for my players that weren't aware of the Huldra, the way their backs look.
Yep. They have a hollow in their back, like a hole in a rotten tree. And they have cow or fox tails.
Mm-hmm.
The cow tail was more Norwegian and the fox tail is more Icelandic. I'm sorry, Finnish. The Huldra originate from the Huldrahalsen in the magical forest inside the Svartafar Mountains, but they love to, a subset of them anyway, love to live among people and pass themselves off as human. And they typically stay until someone notices their tail, and then they disappear. So in the capital city of Koryngard, there is a Huldra woman who runs the most popular mead hall and makes the world's greatest mead. And her tail pops out all the time. And everyone there pretends they can't see it because they're terrified she'll get offended and they'll leave. And so you can imagine like some newbie coming in and spotting the tail and starting to talk about it. And, you know, another Viking guy just knocking him out before he could say anything, because don't let her go and take. And in fact, that would be a great on the fly adventure, is she's gotten offended and run away. You've got to find her and convince her to come back.
That's great. I've noticed that you, and I like this convention, I've noticed that you use the same adventurers in artwork a lot for things. You know, they're almost like an iconic group of adventurers that show up. And I like that convention of having iconic adventurers for an RPG or a setting. So I appreciate that. I was just wondering, is there any details on those characters anywhere?
Yes, there's a ton, because they are the my original players, my group. You know, they were playing, they made their characters in Hero Forge, and we were playing, we were playing online, but we were using tokens made in Hero Forge. And then when I started doing the other books, I commissioned artwork of their characters and surprised them with it. And so now I use those original. They're now playing new characters in our Tales of Valiant game, but the iconics that appear on all the covers and in some of the interiors are my original players.
If there is one thing that I actually miss from 3.5, which I loved it, but I can't go back, but it's the idea that they had iconic characters for things. So you had this image of, this is what your fighter looks like, this is what your, you know, what your sorcerer looks like. I like that there was that touchstone for a lot of these characters.
Yeah, and the Frostborn heritage, which is the people who are, one parent is a giant. In the books, the only time we've ever heard that happen is my character, Theana Frostborn. But one of my players plays a Frostborn character named Leif. He's the big, brown-skinned, blonde-haired, almost giant. We've worked in that he's now the second known Frostborn heritage character that the world has seen. And there must be more out there, but he's the only one that like people have heard of other than Theana Frostborn.
Mm-hmm.
There's a dwarf who's actually Arlish. She's from the land of Arland, who's come, and he's insane. He's a warlock of the Norns, because one of the Norns appeared to him when he was in Arland and told him to get his ass to Norngard. And he talks to an imaginary friend named Sven. He's played by a player of mine who on TikTok goes by the handle Future Ghostly, and so that's how I identify him. And Ghostly will do Sven's, you know, he'll do him talking to Sven, you know, while we're playing it. It's hysterical, because he'll consult with Sven, he'll talk about people in the room to Sven. In fact, I'd love to novelize some of those sessions one day, because we used to, when we were doing that, the player used to write up session notes in the voice of the dwarf talking to his invisible buddy.
I have notes from a Storm King's Thunder campaign that I was in playing a Firbolg barbarian from one of the Uthgart tribes. I was having a blast doing it, but I was also spending hours after game sessions just coming up with what he would have thought about for these things and everything. It was a lot of fun, though. So I almost hate to touch on this, but I don't, because I hate it when very bad people ruin fandoms for me. And one of the things that I really, really, really hate is that you have a lot of white supremacists and people of that mindset that like to appropriate Norse symbolism and mythology. And I don't like it because I love these things, and I don't want anyone to assume that I agree with any of that stuff based on someone else appropriating this. So I just wondered, do you have any thoughts on that particular unfortunate state of affairs?
Yeah, no Nazis in Valhalla. I mean, you're talking to somebody with a shaved head, and I started shaving my head in the early, in the mid-90s, where white guys didn't do that by and large.
Yeah.
I shaved it once in college, and a good friend of mine who is from Bengali was afraid of me afterwards, and I immediately grew it back. Because I was horrified of that, and I was in Charlottesville, which we now know has a large white supremacy population. And I was walking around, and two skinheads started following me around. One of them was like, at different times, and one of them was like, "What affiliation are you with?" And I was like, "No affiliation, F off." So I immediately grew it back. But then nature had other plans for my hair, and it left me pretty fast in my 20s. And it was around that time, actually, that Michael Jordan made the cover of GQ. And it was like the first time a bald man had been on GQ. and then Patrick Stewart, you know, they were finding out that he was a sex symbol. And, you know, they fired that doctor they brought in second season. They brought Dr. Crusher back. But then they realized they needed actually to have Stewart hook up with a lot of different people. And Stewart started shaving his head closer and closer to the skull until he just got rid of it entirely. And so it started to become acceptable for white guys to shave their head. And so I rode that, the crest of that wave. And in fact, you know what's sad about that is that people used to come up to me and rub my head all the time. I would go in a bar and people would start rubbing my head, and it felt really nice. Once it became common, no one does that. Not that I want anybody to rub my head now. I'm happily married, thank you. You know, my attitude at the time was, I'm not going to let the Nazis have it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm not going to let it. I'm not going to let them have this haircut. This haircut looks great on me. I'm not going to have let them have this haircut. And I'm not going to let them have the Norse mythology. And then also, that's a huge disservice to, like, the entire Scandinavian region. You know,
yeah.
Shout out. I love the Grimfrost podcast that they're doing. Grimfrost being a company that makes authentic Norse clothing in Sweden. They outfitted the TV show Vikings. They do videos on YouTube and it's also a podcast where they talk to experts on Norse food. They had a guy on who built his own longship. They have people who reconstruct Viking recipes. They have talked to Jackson Crawford, the guy in Colorado who's an expert on Norse language. Just because some completely racist inbred bigots here have appropriated it, they can't have it. Can't have it. It's not theirs. It never was.
One of my favorite things in recent years was Idris Elba playing Heimdall. Just as a gigantic middle finger to people, because Idris Elba is awesome and did a great job in that role. Probably gave it more gravitas than just any random person that you would have cast for that role would have been able to give it.
I'm so upset that they eliminated the bulk of the Asgardians. I hope that they will do that storyline where Thor goes around and resurrects everyone and they can bring them all back, because I think that was stupid. Like, getting rid of the Time Lords? Why are you throwing out all of these wonderful foils for your main character?
Someday, when I have the comic book podcast that I'm fated to have for all of my digressions, I will go into the weird highs and lows that I felt between Infinity War and Endgame. Because I absolutely love Endgame. And Infinity War is just like, why are you doing some of this stuff? Especially with Thor, because there's so much stuff in Ragnarok that it just felt like they kind of messed with when they did what they did in there.
I do like Ragnarok, though. But gosh, in Loki, when Loki sings in Norwegian, he's probably singing in Ancient Norse.
Mm-hmm.
That was amazing. I got chills.
Now that we've had our, how many comic book digressions so far?
Yep.
I know we've already talked about this a little bit, but just to summarize, is there anything coming up beyond Fury of the Forsaken that you want to, like, seed out there?
If we don't hit the stretch goals of converting the campaign setting and the adventure book, I'll probably do those as future projects. There is a bestiary, and the bestiary is in the works now, and it's not, it's a bestiary for the whole continent. And it has a lot of really interesting monsters. I'm very excited to put that out. And then have, and also have that as a kind of Bible I can hand to my the people who write for me to design with and say, here, use these monsters. Because I try in all the books to avoid using anything you've seen before. They're all new monsters in every adventure, and or at least they're my monsters. I try to avoid pulling stuff from you know, the BFRD or the SRD and giving you new things. And so there's quite a lot of monsters that haven't come out yet. There's something called a Mumblarkin. I can't wait to show people. The plan is to do the big monster book paired with a hardcover adventure anthology. I may tease out some of the adventures sooner. I was in both of Cobalt Press's adventure packs, the add-on adventure packs for their two Tales of Valiant Kickstarters. Well, that was awesome. I think I was away from my own Kickstarters for too long. So I may do some mini Kickstarters, maybe just on backer kit with some of these short adventures to just... because it's going to take a while to do the monster book. And then, like I said, there's something called Crisis in Castlebriar, which takes place in Nillinia. And that's a back burner project, but has a ton of artwork for it already. And it's about... the Banner of the Bull is why the Fae aren't invading Norngard. You know, Norngard has its own Fae, but the Celtic Fae, the Seelie and Unseelie, can't come to Norngard. And Banner of the Bull is why. But they are elsewhere. There are some things that have been keeping them out of the world. And the island I mentioned in the Once Upon a Unicorn is called the Glistening Isles. And the Glistening Isles used to be a human population. And then the Fae came and took it. And they didn't just take it, they rewrote it. So what used to be mundane islands are now Fae islands. They literally like stitched a piece of the Fae realm, which is called Elswither, onto these islands. You know, they swapped it out. It is fairy. It's a portion of fairy on the world of Qualf that operates according to fairy rules. The Court of Flowers lives in the north. They factor heavily in the book Once Upon a Unicorn. But you hear about the Court of Thorns to the south, and you never see them. And so what the Court of Thorns are up to during the events of Once Upon a Unicorn is what A Crisis in Castlebriar will deal with. As there is a Fae incursion, because they, you know, the Glistening Isles are their beachhead, but they would like all of it back. Thank you very much. It used to be our playground. We can't play there as often as we'd like. We'd like to change that. And so I've got some really scary Fae that we've done. Really, really, really scary Fae. And I'm really looking forward to getting to that. And then my answer to the Wild Hunt that I'm working on, and it takes place in the Dornwald, is a huge woods between Nillinia and Termini, and humans came in and cut a road through it. And to keep it growing back, they have planted these iron coins that prevent the forest from growing back. But in splitting the Dornwald, they've really messed with the ecology there. And it's kind of created some imbalances. And that plays into the Wild Hunt and to someone called the Moss Queen. That's a whole story I'm going to tell.
Speaking of things in... deities and demigods and legends and lore that captured my imagination, the Wild Hunt has been like burned into my brain since I first saw that in those books.
yep. Saeslin is the England, but it's just come out of the Long War. The king has gone mad, and there's a civil war brewing there that's going to break out, and I want to do some, you know, for Fear of the Forsaken, I created a mass combat system for the final battle. And I want to do an expanded version of that in a standalone book called Battlecraft. And I'm thinking that it probably needs its own couple of sample adventures. And so they may deal with the civil war in Saesland. And then up in Rosnia, all the cities have been independent up until now. But the prince of this one large city has always used the title Prince of All Rosnia. He's decided that that title is literal, not just figurative. And so he's trying to unify the country. But there are people who... Or, you know, I didn't know we had a king. And also, the eastern half of Rosnia is the western half of Azaria. And the eastern half of Azaria was conquered by the Ischiri Empire. You have a disputed territory between Azaria and Rosnia. And then you have some other powerful entities. There's a black dragon that rules one city, probably doesn't want to bow to a prince. And there is an evil Santa Claus that rules another city. And so unifying Rosnia, if that's even a good thing to do, is a storyline I want to explore. But I'm curious, what your players, what areas are they from?
Our paladin ended up being from Theka.
Okay.
Our rogue ended up being from the Gordian Supremacy.
Yep.
We had a wizard that was from Arland, and our druid is from Norengard, but she was actually a foundling wood elf that a druid grove took in and raised her in that tradition. And then we have a dark elf who is a warlock whose patron is an ancestor that is trying to reform dark elf society.
Awesome. So Arland is a matriarchy. It had a Queen Boudica type figure who was more successful in expelling the Gordian Empire than Boudica was in expelling the Roman Empire. She had a Merlin-like figure that helped her, and she had a sword, which is now the sword Whitestorm that Karn carries. And it was way more powerful back then. The magic has faded. It was way more powerful. She established a matriarchy. So everyone in Ireland uses matronomics, not patronomics. So instead of Mick and Mac, it's Nick and Knack, which means daughter of. And there's a druid college, and there's a bard's college, and there's a high wood elf population. And the queen is currently building the world's largest cannon. I think they still probably paint themselves blue when they go into battle. And it's kind of, I don't want to diminish two real world cultures, but it's kind of like half of Ireland is more Irish and half is more Scottish.
Mm-hmm.
And the big secret of the world, plug your ears, players, is the druids of Ireland are the ones who work their butt off to keep the Fae out. And I won't say how they're doing that, but they're keeping the Fae out. And small Fae can, you know, there are doors, and small Fae can come back and forth between Elsweather whenever they want. They can pop out of a mushroom or a hole in a tree or from out of a bush or whatever. But the larger Fae, larger being synonymous with more powerful, they can only come at certain times of the year. They're restricted to when the moon is exactly right, or we're on, you know, we're at the equinox or Beltane or wherever, and they hate that. They want to be able to come and go as they please. So they are currently working to change it up where they don't have to be restricted and only come, you know, on this night and only for the night. And so, you know, a lot of what we're going to see is intimations that they are trying to change the status quo. And specifically, the Court of Thorns is after that. So Theka is interesting. Theka, it's fantasy Greece, but it's huge. It's a continent, an island continent. It's not actually part of Catania. It's its own continent. And Theka was fantasy Greece, and then it was conquered by the Gordian Empire. And then when the Gordian Empire fell, it went through several hands, and then it was just exploited for a long, long time. And about, I think it's 62 years ago, a city called Caldera, which is highly modeled on Sparta, where you have a matriarchal culture. It's sort of Sparta meets the Amazons, that live on a city, on a caldera, in a lake, in an extinct volcano. They enslaved the wyverns using something called the Horn of Osius, which Osius ruled. It was a founder who built a horn that can enslave dragons and used it to take over the world. There was a light elf empire. Osius was a human who built the Horn of Osius, took over the dragons, and decimated the Light Elf Empire. The Light Elves still exist in Yasselfaria, which is, they're isolationists, they're assholes. They don't come out of their mountains. They may be monkeying with space travel, rediscovering space travel. And the Thekans got a hold of the Wyverns, and with that, they unified the country because they had basically Grecian lances that shoot Greek fire, and they could fly. And so they took over every other city. And it's a little bit of Flash Gordon, where you have a Minotaur city, and you have a city of dryads, and you have a city of naiads, and oh, it was naiads, I'm sorry, naiads are the, not dryads in my water city. And so they're ruling all the other cities through fear and intimidation and the fact that they can shoot fire from the sky. And that collapses in the third book of the Thrones and Bones series. But when they took over the country, because the country had been exploited for 1,000 years, they were reactionary. They became neoclassicists. So they rebuilt the ancient Greek society. So you've got a Grecian-type world in what is the High Middle Ages, living according to classical Greek principles. So that's Theka. And then Sarn's Teeth below it, the archipelago, is all the islands of Jason the Argonauts. And let's see, you said the Sacred Gordian Supremacy is basically the Eastern Roman Empire, except it's Phrygian, not Roman. It's a Phrygian culture that merged with a Latin culture. So the organization of their military is along Roman lines with legions, and, you know, they outfitted like that. But they wear the funky hats that the Vulcans wore, that the Phrygian cap, and their fashion is Phrygian, and their gods are Phrygian. So they worship Cybassos, the god on horseback, and the mother goddess, Cybele. And so those are their gods. But they have retreated to the Sacred Garden Supremacy is now just one giant Constantinople-like city. The western half isn't far away. It's Gordion, which is the western half, and that's where the empire originally came from. And there's a whole displaced Mesoamerican culture, the Ixtan Triple Alliance, which is the Aztec, Inca, and Mayan cultures, and they are not from the world. They're from somewhere else that got stuck here. And so even though it's kind of Western Europe, the southwest is Mesoamerica. And then that's separated from the Egyptian land of the Teru, which is all ruled by cats. all the gods are cat-headed. And the cats people take that as a symbol that it's supposed to be the cat above the human. Cat head on a human body. So all the pharaohs are cats. The lion folk are the military, and humans are everything else. They can't do much against the Ixtan Triple Alliance because there's this area called the Wasteland of Chicxulub. And this is Omec. But the wasteland of Chicxulub is entirely surrounded by these giant heads. And if you try and walk into the wasteland of Chicxulub, giant fists will bust out of the earth and squish you flat. So no one knows what's in there. There's probably fabulous treasure in there, but you can't get in. And flight is not common in this world, at least except in the Asian land, and where they have treasure fleets that fly, which we meet in one of the adventures and one of the stories in Stokey's Hall. But, you know, and if you were to try and fly into Chicxulub, the hands would probably throw projectiles at you. But there are these jade jaguar masks. And if you can find one, you can walk right past them. But, you know, can you find one? And who knows what's in there, what ancient treasures or technologies or magics are in there. So, you know, there's a lot going on the continent, both in terms of like politics, where societies are on the verge of civil war or are transforming themselves or are trying, kicking and screaming to get into the modern age. And in terms of some weird places, even though it's a highly developed continent, there's whole areas that are dangerous. And everything goes through Nilenia because there's two mountain ranges above and below it. So if to get from the western half to the eastern half, you got to go through Nilenia. So Nilenia is benefits from that trade.
I love just odd things that are artifacts of something where people have stories about them. Because in D&D, you can do things like, no, there's going to be a giant fist that comes out and smashes you. Yep. Like, no, those are just big giant heads. No, you don't want to try that.
Nope, there are whole giant bodies under there. Yep.
Dear listener, if you are listening to this from the Patreon feed, you're going to have about 3 days to back this. And if you're listening from the Polygamers Podcast Network site, go back it right now, because I think you have until tomorrow. However, I was just going to ask Lou, are you doing something beyond the regular Kickstarter limit here?
Yeah, so I think it's the 29th that it closes, but provided it funds, because we hadn't funded yet, we're 85% there. Provided it funds, they'll be we're taking advantage of Kickstarter's new feature where you can continue to back for a period of time. The delivery date I've got is December, but if we don't hit any of the big stretch goals that require me to do whole other books, I will deliver much faster than that. So I wouldn't count on that running more than about 2 to 3 months past the end of the Kickstarter. But please back us now so that we get there. And if we do hit one of those books, that'll be fantastic. And there are also a lot of cool stretch goals. We've got Heroic Maps have done for this one. I've worked with them on everything so far, but for this one, they did over 20 locations, and then they did day, night, gridded, ungridded, indoor, outdoor, and then for some of the locations, during the battle on fire versions. I think counting all the variations, there's like 256 maps.
Wow.
We're offering the map pack as a $60 add-on for whatever, but it will be $114 when it's sold afterwards. And then we've got the Adventures on Shard tabletop, if you want to, and we'll have two different versions of Fury on Shard, because there are so many maps. I can't give them all away for $30. Because
yeah,
yo, at Heroic Maps will be like, "What? I'm selling this for $114." So, rightly so, because it's a massive map pack. So there's going to be a standard edition of the Shard tabletop, which is just one version of each map, the one you're most likely to need, and then the deluxe version, which is all the variations. I think I'll probably put the hardcover version of the player's guide in as an add-on. If I don't do it during the campaign, I'll do it during the Pledge Magic phase or the post campaign phase on Kickstarter. So if you want to get everything to play with Tales of the Valiant, you can.
This show is funded by the Gnomes Do Patreon. You too can become a Patreon backer by following the Patreon link to the Gnomes Do website to the Gnomes Do Patreon. We love doing this, and the Patreon helps us keep this going. The Gnomecast is part of the Polygamers Podcast Network. So if you're enjoying us, here's another show you should check out. Oh, this one sounds familiar. Thaco with Advantage. Ange and I love talking about RPGs and D&D. Together we share insights into the games that we're running in the campaign journal, then tackle a variety of topics that affect the game in the DM's workshop. We're going to talk anyway, so we might as well record it. Maybe you'll even pick up an ancient D&D factoid from a previous edition of the game that you will never use. You can find all the gnomes at gnomesdo.com, along with Gnomes Do on Facebook, Blue Sky, Instagram, and Threads. Lou, are there some places where people can find you that you'd like to shout out?
Absolutely. So there's Thrones and Bones page on Facebook. We have a Discord, the Thrones and Bones official Discord. You can find all the products on DriveThruRPG. You can either look up Thrones and Bones or Lazy Wolf Studios. We have the website, lazywolfstudios.com. And I have a newsletter on Ghost called Lazy Wolves. The base newsletter is free, and I put a lot of stuff out there. You know, all news will be announced there and on the Discord first.
Hopefully, we can keep up the tradition of not throwing anyone into the stew in front of our special guests. So I think we're going to make it out of the stew pot this episode. Thanks for listening.